You know how sometimes you see leaders start strong, right?
Yeah.
Like full of potential, everyone's excited, but then things just sort of fall apart.
Yeah, it's a classic story. Happens all the time, even way back in history.
Exactly. And that's what we're diving into today on The Deep Dive, a story like that, a story about a king, King Saul.
Very interesting choice. I'm excited to explore this.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at his early reign using a fascinating lecture by Dr. Robert Van Oy. He's a scholar of the books of 1st and 2nd Samuel. We have some excerpts from one of his lectures, specifically Van Oy Samuel's Lecture 03.pdf. You can find a link to the full thing in the show notes.
Sounds good.
So what's really cool about this deep dive for me is that it's not just some ancient history lesson. It actually gives us a really powerful way to think about leadership, even today. Dr. Van Oy breaks down where Saul went wrong, and it's surprisingly relevant to anyone in a leadership role, or honestly, anyone making big decisions.
I can see that. There are definitely some timeless principles at play here.
Absolutely. So our mission for you today is to go beyond the surface level story of King Saul. We're going to unpack the key moments, the pivotal decisions, and really understand what they reveal about leadership and what it means to actually stay true to your core values.
Okay, I'm ready. Where do we begin?
Well, let's lay the groundwork first. So the whole deep dive today focuses on how Saul's kingship, even though it was officially established, didn't actually live up to the ideal. It didn't reflect that core covenantal relationship between God and Israel.
Right, that's a key point to remember. This covenant, this agreement between God and his people, is fundamental to understanding the whole story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the lecture really hones in on two crucial passages in 1 Samuel that illustrate this. Chapters 13 and 15. They're like case studies in leadership gone wrong.
Yeah, Dr. Van Oy actually gives us a helpful framework to think about this, and it revolves around this idea of kingship and covenant. He reminds us that the Israelites' initial desire for a king was, in a way, a rejection of God as their direct leader. They wanted someone visible, someone tangible to rule over them.
But then Samuel, the prophet, he actually sets up the kingship in a way that's meant to be consistent with that covenant.
Right, so the kingship itself wasn't the problem. The problem was how Saul actually ruled. He didn't live up to that covenantal ideal. And later on, we see a different model with King David. His kingship, though not perfect, reflects that covenantal relationship in a much deeper way.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. The story really starts to unravel surprisingly quickly, like right off the bat. In 1 Samuel chapter 13,
I'm all ears.
this is right after Saul's big inauguration ceremony at Gilgal. They've renewed the covenant, everyone's celebrating, and boom, we start seeing these cracks appear. Saul doesn't follow through on a really important instruction he received from the Lord way back when he was first anointed.
Okay, so we need to rewind a bit. The timing here is super significant, isn't it? This act of disobedience happening right after this covenant renewal, it just highlights how crucial this initial test of Saul's leadership was.
And to understand what he did wrong, Dr. Van Oy actually points us back to 1 Samuel 10, verses 7 and 8. This is where Samuel anoints Saul as king and tells him that the Spirit of the Lord will come upon him and then he should do whatever his hand finds.
Right, and that whatever specifically involved attacking the Philistine garrison at Gibeah, this was like the first step in God's promise to deliver Israel from Philistine oppression through Saul.
But here's a really interesting detail. Saul doesn't even tell his own uncle about being anointed or about this task. You'd think that would be pretty big news to share, wouldn't you? Hey, uncle, guess what? God chose me to be king, and I'm supposed to go take on these Philistines. But nope, nothing.
Yeah, that's odd, right? That silence is really telling. It could suggest that he wasn't exactly jumping at the chance, maybe even hesitant or lacking faith in the task. And then, boom, we have this stark contrast with his son, Jonathan. Dr. Van Noy emphasizes how, in 1 Samuel 13.3, it's Jonathan, not Saul, who actually takes the initiative and attacks this Philistine outpost at Gibeah.
Which is probably just another spelling of Gibeah, by the way.
Yeah, most likely. But the point is, Jonathan's actions seems way more in line with that original instruction given to Saul. He's the one acting like the decisive leader.
It's almost like the son is showing up the father in terms of kingly courage. And of course, Jonathan's attack, well, it provokes a major response from the Philistines. They gather a huge army, I mean massive, and set up camp at Michmash, as described in 1 Samuel 13.5.
Yeah, talk about pressure. And how do the Israelites react to this? Not exactly a picture of a nation united and confident behind their new king.
No, not at all.
Dr. Van Noy, he quotes Walter Brueggemann here, who points out how these verses describe the Philistines as having just overwhelming superiority. Numbers, weapons, the whole nine yards.
Yep.
And the Israelites, they're terrified, hiding in caves, thickets, desperate, totally trapped.
It says that even Saul's own men at Gilgal were trembling with fear, and some even deserted, ran off to the other side of the Jordan River. So much for having a king to protect them.
Right. The irony is thick here. They wanted a king for security, but now, under their new king, they're just as scared, maybe even more so. It really makes you wonder what kind of leader Saul was proving to be at this point.
Totally. It's not exactly inspiring confidence. And this is the backdrop for Saul's first major act of disobedience. Remember, he had gone to Gilgal, as Samuel had instructed him, and he was supposed to wait there for 7 days until Samuel arrived to make these crucial sacrifices and give him further guidance. But Samuel was delayed.
And as the military situation got worse and worse, with the Philistine threat looming large, Saul decided to take matters into his own hands.
He basically went rogue. In 1 Samuel 13, verses 8 through 12, we see him looking at his dwindling forces and thinking, I got to do something. The lecture even points out that the original Hebrew word here could be translated as he forced himself, suggesting a real sense of desperation. So he goes ahead and offers the sacrifices himself, even though Samuel hadn't arrived yet.
Classic case of impatience and fear driving a bad decision.
Big time. And guess what?
Right.
The moment he finishes offering the sacrifices, who shows up? Samuel. And he immediately confronts Saul. What have you done?
Awkward.
Yeah, talk about bad timing. And Saul's response, as Dr. Van Oy points out, it's full of justifications. He's like, look, the circumstances were tough. I had no other choice. But the core lesson here, and this is so relevant, is about the long-term consequences of these short-term fear-driven decisions.
Right. It reveals a fundamental misunderstanding of his role as a leader under God. He was supposed to be relying on God's strength and guidance, not giving in to panic and taking shortcuts.
And Samuel, he's not buying it. He delivers this scathing rebuke, telling Saul straight up that his actions were foolish, and that because of this disobedience, his dynasty would not be established. And then he drops a bombshell. The Lord has already chosen someone else, a man after his own heart. That's in 1 Samuel 13, verses 13 and 14. Talk about a turning point.
It's a huge moment. And Dr. Van Oy really gets to the heart of Saul's error here. He asks this crucial question. Would Saul be a king who's accountable to God, or would he act independently, calling the shots? Would he trust in God's timing and plan, even when things looked bleak, or would he put his own judgment above God's instructions? That was the central issue here, the nature of kingship within this covenant relationship.
And the lecture makes this really important distinction about Saul's motivations. Just because he performed a religious act, offering the sacrifices, it doesn't automatically mean his heart was in the right place. There's a huge difference between genuine devotion, rooted in trust and obedience, and just going through the motions to try to justify disobedience.
Yeah, it's like he had the outward form of religion, but not the inner substance. Dr. Van Noy even quotes Gordon MacDonald, who said that Saul had not much notion of obedience to God, but he had some idea of respect of religion. It's a subtle but crucial difference.
And sadly, this wasn't a one-time slip-up. The lecture touches on 1 Samuel chapter 14, and we see this pattern continuing. Saul keeps prioritizing his own will, and maybe even his public image, over clear obedience to God.
Yeah, chapter 14 is full of examples that contrast really poorly with Jonathan's actions. We see Saul making impulsive decisions, like that rash oath he puts on his men, saying they can't eat until they've avenged themselves on their enemies. He even starts to build an altar but doesn't finish it, probably distracted by chasing the Philistines. And then there's that foolish vow that almost gets Jonathan killed because he unknowingly broke the eating oath.
It's almost like he's using religious language and actions as a cover for his own agenda, or to make himself look righteous, even when his decisions are questionable.
And again, the contrast with Jonathan is so striking. While Saul's actions are hindering the battle, Jonathan's the one who brings about a significant victory. Even Jonathan recognizes how messed up his dad's leadership is, saying, "My father has made trouble for the country."
Ouch. Right to the point.
Yeah. The lecture quotes VP Long here, who says that the day started with Jonathan's courageous initiative, but ended with him barely escaping death because of his father's actions. It's a real missed opportunity. And Saul just becomes more and more isolated, alienating even his own troops because of his stubbornness and bad judgment.
By the end of chapter 14, it's clear that Saul's ability to be king is seriously in question.
Absolutely. And this leads us to what Dr. Van Noy presents as the decisive failure in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Here, Samuel comes to Saul with a new command directly from the Lord. This one's very specific. Completely destroy the Amalekites. It's an act of judgment for their past aggression against Israel, going all the way back to the Exodus.
The lecture reminds us of the backstory here. We can read about it in Exodus 17 and Deuteronomy 25. The Amalekites are portrayed as actively opposing God's people. This command from God isn't arbitrary. It has deep historical and theological roots.
Right. This was a real second chance for Saul, a chance to prove his obedience, his commitment to the Lord. Samuel's instructions are crystal clear. Utterly destroy all that they have, do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey.
Strong words.
Yeah, there's no ambiguity there. And at first, it seems like Saul's actually following through. He gathers his army. He even warns the Kenites, who were friendly to Israel and living among the Amalekites, telling them to separate themselves so they wouldn't be harmed. He defeats the Amalekites, just like the text says, from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt.
So far, so good, right?
Well, not exactly. We get to verses 8 and 9, and here's the catch. While Saul defeated the Amalekites, he spared Agag, their king, and he kept the best of the sheep and cattle, only destroying what was considered worthless or of poor quality. This directly contradicts God's clear command to destroy everything.
Yeah, he basically cherry-picked the parts of the command he liked. It's like he thought he knew better than God.
Right. This highlights a huge temptation for leaders. To selectively apply principles or commands based on their own judgment, on what they think is important or convenient in the moment.
And this is where Samuel confronts Saul again. He delivers the Lord's message. Saul had turned back from following the Lord and had not carried out his commands. The lecture really emphasizes the importance of this phrase, following after Yahweh, in the context of covenantal kingship.
Yeah, it means recognizing God's absolute authority, submitting to his will, not just picking and choosing what you like.
And there's this incredibly telling detail in verse 12. Before even going to Gilgal to meet Samuel, Saul sets up a monument in his own honor at Carmel.
Wow, talk about ego.
Right. Dr. Van Ooy points out how significant this is. It shows that Saul saw the victory as his own accomplishment, something to brag about, instead of an act of divine judgment that he was simply carrying out. This monument is like a symbol of how he's shifting towards seeing himself as an autonomous ruler, accountable only to himself, not to God. That totally goes against the whole idea of Israel's leadership being based on God's authority. And then, when he meets Samuel, he has the nerve to say, "Blessed are you of the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord." He says this right to Samuel's face, knowing full well that he didn't do everything he was told.
It's bold, to say the least. Like, how could he even think he could get away with that?
I know. And when Samuel asks out the sounds of sheep and cattle he hears, Saul tries to explain it away, saying the best animals were spared to be sacrificed to the Lord your God. Notice that phrasing, your God. It's like he's subtly distancing himself from Samuel and from the true nature of their relationship with God.
It's a clever way to try and shift the blame. But Samuel isn't fooled. He delivers that famous rebuke in 1 Samuel 15, verses 22 and 23. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Surely to obey is better than sacrifice. That's the heart of it all, isn't it? God cares more about a genuine, obedient heart than just empty rituals, especially if they're used to cover up disobedience.
Powerful words, and they still resonate today.
They do. The lecture points out how this statement connects to the later prophets who criticized empty religious practices. God's not interested in outward displays of piety if they're not backed up by a sincere desire to follow his commands. And then Samuel really drives the point home, equating rebellion with divination and insubordination with idolatry. That's serious stuff. And the consequence is clear. Because Saul rejected the word of the Lord has rejected him as king.
Talk about consequences.
Yeah, it doesn't get much heavier than that.
Faced with this, Saul finally confesses, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice." But even in this confession, there's this sense of deflection. He admits he sinned, but then he immediately blames it on being afraid of the people. He puts fear of people above fear of God, which is a complete reversal of how things should be.
And then he asks for forgiveness and wants Samuel to go back with him to worship. But it seems like his main concern is saving face. "Please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel." It makes you wonder how genuine his repentance really is.
Samuel sees right through it. He refuses to go back with Saul, making it clear that God has rejected him. And then, in this symbolic act, when Saul grabs the hem of Samuel's robe to try to stop him from leaving, the robe tears.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Samuel says that just as the robe is torn, so the Lord has torn the kingdom away from Saul and given it to someone better. That's a clear foreshadowing of David.
The lecture has a really interesting interpretation of verse 31, too. Dr. Van Ooy, following Robert Alter's translation, suggests it should be understood as, Samuel turned back from Saul, and Saul bowed down to the Lord. So instead of Samuel going back with Saul to worship, it's actually emphasizing Samuel's complete rejection of him, leaving Saul to worship alone. It's like a public display of his diminished status.
Yeah, that's a powerful image. And then Samuel takes it upon himself to finish what Saul failed to do, executing King Gag. The chapter ends with this definitive separation between Samuel and Saul, marking the end of their relationship and the end of Saul's legitimate reign in God's eyes. The stage is set for David's rise, while Saul's story takes a tragic turn, leading ultimately to his death.
It's a sobering reminder of how actions have consequences, even for those in positions of power.
Absolutely. Saul's early reign is this cautionary tale showing us how failing to prioritize obedience, failing to stick to your principles, even when things get tough, or when you think you have good intentions, can lead to huge negative consequences, not just for you as a leader, but for everyone you lead.
Right. And it really forces us to think about the difference between just doing religious things and actually living out our faith in a way that's aligned with our core values. We can see these same dynamics playing out today, can't we? The struggle between doing what's expedient and doing what's right, mm-hmm. between trying to please people and staying true to what we believe in.
All the time.
Exactly. So here's a question to consider, and it's a big one. What does it actually mean to be a leader after God's own heart? It's more than just a nice saying. It has real implications for how we lead, how we make decisions, and how can we learn from Saul's mistakes, from his downfall, to understand the importance of integrity and the impact it has on everything we do.
That's something worth thinking about for sure.
It is. And maybe the biggest takeaway here is how easy it is for our own ambitions, even when we think they're noble, to overshadow those core principles that we claim to uphold. It's a subtle trap, but a dangerous one. Something to keep in mind long after this deep dive is over.
Thanks for joining us today on The Deep Dive. Be sure to check the show notes for links to the source material and other resources. And until next time, keep thinking deeply.
See you then.